Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, standing with all Californians as we address the coronavirus emergency together, on the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we hear about efforts to protect the Valley's most at-risk residents from COVID-19. And we get a historic perspective from a Fresno woman whose life began just after the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. But first, what's it like to be in the United States applying for asylum during a pandemic? FM89's Madi Bolaños has this story of a couple whose journey started last fall in Mexico.
Roxana Espinoza Trigueros and her wife Carolina applied for asylum in the United States after living in Mexico for 3 years. They say they were discriminated against for being a couple. Once they were notified that their application was being considered, they went to an office in San Isidro near the border. There, they spent 11 nights in a room they said was referred to as the hielera, or the freezer.
It's a room that's very cold where there are a lot of people. They only gave us aluminum sheets to cover ourselves with.
That's 29-year-old Carolina. She and Roxana, who's 49, slept on the floor with roughly 25 other women. She says they weren't allowed to shower every day, but when they were forced to wear the same dirty clothes they had on.
They gave us only a burrito. All of us became constipated because that's all they would feed us, and we could only drink water from the sink in the bathroom, which was extremely cold as well.
They first fled their home country, El Salvador, 3 years ago after facing harassment from members of their community, including Roxana's ex-husband, with whom she shares 3 kids.
Once my children's father found out, he began to verbally harass us, until one day he forced us out of the house I share with my children. That's when we decided to go to Mexico.
And from Mexico to the United States, Roxana and Carolina were transferred from San Isidro to Mesa Verde Detention Center in Bakersfield in October.
They're married. They were planning to go live with Roxana's family in Texas and submitted a parole request because after asylum seekers pass that initial credible fear screening interview, they're eligible to ask for release on a parole bond.
That's Lisa Knox with Centro Legal de la Raza in Oakland. She represents both women. Although their applications were nearly identical, Carolina was granted a $10,000 bond, but Roxana was denied. Carolina's bond was too high for their family to pay, says Knox. And with Roxana's parole denied, Carolina decided to stay at Mesa Verde with her wife. 2 months later, they learned about the coronavirus while watching the news.
When we heard about the pandemic, we all got scared because they gave us only a 10-milliliter bottle to clean ourselves and wash dishes. That's the antibacterial stuff they gave us.
When Roxana asked for better cleaning supplies, she says ICE officers denied her request, saying she might use it to harm other detainees.
They say that we were taking precautions, but that was false. There were many officials that came to work with the cough. They continued to bring in people. There were 3 officers who came with the cough, hiccups, and a fever.
Although ICE said it is currently screening officers who come into the facility and encourages detainees to do everything they can to social distance, lawyer Lisa Knox was worried about her clients.
The facility wasn't really giving them information. You know, they were told to wash their hands, to practice social distancing, which of course is impossible under those conditions. And they just weren't really given information about any other steps that were going to be taken.
She was particularly worried about Roxana, who has hypertension and colitis, a chronic digestive disease. So she joined an ACLU lawsuit against ICE, demanding the release of 12 people who are at risk of contracting COVID-19.
ICE did decide to reconsider the parole request for both of the women. And so they reconsidered and granted Roxana a $4,000 bond and her wife as well.
After 6 months in Mesa Verde, both women are now with Roxana's family in Texas, where they will await the final hearing on their asylum application. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Adi Bolaños.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. COVID-19 has touched all of our lives, but some communities are especially impacted. To learn about efforts to protect those of us who are most at risk, I spoke with Lisa Blecker, Pesticide Safety Education Program Coordinator for the UC Division of Agriculture and Natural Resources, Laura Moreno, Chair of the Fresno Madera Continuum of Care, and Kristen Beal Watson, CEO of the Kern Community Foundation.
So, Kristen, I'd like to start with you. The Kern County COVID-19 Relief Fund was created by the Kern Community Foundation to support the region's most vulnerable residents. What are the populations being served by the fund?
So that's a good question. It's actually a pretty wide variety. As you can imagine, vulnerable populations encompasses a lot. So we're looking at isolated rural communities, whether they're north of us, in Delano, McFarland, those areas, or even to the south of us up into Fraser Park. But communities who really don't have the resources that maybe we see in the larger metropolitan areas. Additionally, we're serving seniors, obviously homeless, socioeconomically disadvantaged children, veterans, ag workers. The list just goes on and on.
It certainly does. There are so many people that are impacted right now. And you did mention the homeless population. I'd like to expand a bit more on that. Laura Moreno, you're with the Fresno Madera Continuum of Care. Can you give us an update on the work being done to provide housing for people who are experiencing homelessness at this time?
Yes. And so let me start by saying that the state of California took a very proactive approach to protecting our vulnerable homeless population against COVID-19. So early on, the couple of the departments at the state started looking at how do we bring people inside quickly, because they knew that folks out on the street were already vulnerable. They're already in those high-risk categories for COVID-19. And so how do we bring them in? One, to protect them, and two, to prevent the spread. Because of the way that people are forced to live when they're outside, they're much more vulnerable, and the spread could potentially be worse in those situations. So the state contacted all of the jurisdictions, and particularly through the continuums of care, and started laying out some plans, and so as well provided funding through a mechanism that had already been developed the year or two before. And so thankfully, the two governors previous started putting money into homelessness, and so processes were already set up. And last year, the jurisdiction was able to bring online over 100 new beds targeting homeless, and not just emergency shelter beds, but they were triage shelters aimed at getting people housed, and so wrapped them with a variety of services. So the structure was already in place, and so we have been able, with partnership with the state and with funding, been able to add an additional almost 300 beds in the last month. And it was an amazing process that this jurisdiction, Fresno and Madera areas, were able to pull together with private providers, and we were able to add 300 beds in a matter of just a few days. It was absolutely less than a week that we were able to add those. And so we have added overall about 400 or so beds, and that is really just to bring people inside. We need to bring our vulnerable populations inside. We looked at the most vulnerable first, which was over the age of 65 and those that had underlying health conditions. We needed to make sure that we got those folks inside. Outreach teams from various agencies were involved, and they went in and brought those people in, and then we opened it up to everyone else and have brought in over 400 people. To at least the very first step of it was just getting people inside, sheltering in place inside, and ensuring that those shelters are safe, that staff are safe, that clients are safe, and then looking at our existing shelters as well, those that were not just created in this with this pandemic, but were opened last year, and how we keep people safe there as well.
So do you have a sense at this point of how many people in Fresno and Madera counties are still without shelter?
So if we look at the point in time count that was conducted in 2019, so every year this Fresno Madera Continuum of Care has conducted a point in time count. It's been probably the last 5 or 6 years we've been doing it every year. HUD requires that we do it every other year, but we felt like it was very valuable information and necessary, and it has proven to be very helpful. So in the 2019 PIT count, we did a 2021, but the numbers haven't been released yet. In 2019, just in Fresno and Madera counties, there were 2,069 people that were unsheltered, homeless. In the city of Fresno, there were 935. So we've added, like I said, almost 400 beds. So if we just do the math, we figure that there's still over 500 people that are unsheltered at this point. Now, other programs have privately sheltered as well. The Fresno Rescue Mission has been really great about sheltering. So I would say there's probably 450 to 550 people that are still unsheltered just in Metro Fresno. When we look at Fresno County, there were 543 unsheltered, and we haven't added any beds there yet. We're looking at adding 80 beds in the outlying rural areas. So even once we add the 80 beds, we're still going to have approximately 450 people that are unsheltered if we're using the 2019 PIT number. So there's still quite a few people that are left out on the street.
And still lots of work to do to help them out. Well, thank you for that update. I'd like to shift the conversation over to Lisa. Can you speak to the importance of PPE for ag workers? Obviously, to protect them for COVID-19, but for other reasons as well. Just fill us in on why it's so important.
Personal protective equipment, or we call it PPE for short, is essential for people that handle pesticides. And so people who handle pesticides do things like they mix or they load pesticides, and of course they apply pesticides. And PPE is a key layer of protection between pesticides and their bodies. So it protects them from pesticide exposure through one or more of the four routes of exposure. So pesticides can enter your body through eyes, nose, mouth, and skin, and there's PPE to protect through all of those routes. And it helps to prevent both acute and chronic long-term exposure to pesticides. And different pesticides have the potential to harm you in different ways. So the PPE that you wear for one pesticide may be slightly different than the PPE that you wear for another pesticide. So our pesticide handlers are doing, you know, critical ag work out there for us, and they're also doing a potentially harmful job or dangerous job. So it's important that they're protected on a daily basis when they're out there handling pesticides.
And do they have access to the PPE that they need?
Well, I think I have, how do I want to answer that? I don't have firsthand knowledge of whether or not all of the handlers or applicators out there have access to all the PPE that they need, but I know that there is a PPE shortage. So the PPE that is critical for healthcare workers is some of the exact same PPE that pesticide workers also use. So an N95 mask, those are not easy to find at the moment. And sometimes the Tyvek brand coveralls are often sold out, and some of the disposable gloves are also often sold out. So it may be more difficult to find PPE, or they may need to identify alternative PPE, but it is essential that they wear PPE or find another pesticide that doesn't require the PPE that they can't find.
So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We are talking about how COVID-19 is impacting some of the Valley's most vulnerable communities. Kristen, with the Kern Community Foundation, I'd like to turn the conversation back to you. you know, when we talked about the COVID-19 relief fund that your foundation created to protect and support vulnerable residents, you listed a variety of communities that are being deeply impacted. And I'm just wondering, in these difficult times when so many communities are struggling, how do you determine where to allocate your resources?
You know, that's a really, really good question. And I have to tell you, it is incredibly challenging. So we stood this fund up the 16th of March and announced it to the public. And I'm happy to say, you know, originally my thought was we did not need to start a fund. We needed to just direct donations to the nonprofits who are serving vulnerable populations. There was no reason for us to get in the way. But then after talking to several of our business leaders in town, they said, you know what, we are swamped with the fires that we're putting out in our own businesses, and yet we still want to be philanthropically minded. So would you please open a fund so that we can contribute, do our duty philanthropically, and use your grant-making capacity? So happy to say we did that, and to date, we have $450,000 that has come into the fund. That said, we have received a total of 130 grant applications, and the grant process is incredibly abbreviated and expedited because we did not want it to be onerous. And it is a grant that's available to any nonprofit or school or church that's serving in Kern County. And we did have a small pot of money that actually went into Tulare County as well. So we had 129 applications totaling $1.5 million in requests. So you can see we're a little bit short, right? And so our primary focus from day one in this first, what we call tranche of funding, is basic needs. What organizations need those resources that are directly going to go out, provide food, shelter, safety for vulnerable populations? And that has been predominantly where funds have gone out. So people like the Salvation Army, who are providing rental assistance, utility assistance, our homeless shelters, Alliance Against Family Violence, who obviously in difficult times like this, they need support because they see an increase in casework. An organization in East Kern called Bags for Kids that provide resources where families in need can come by and get those resources that they need, whether they're diapers or formula or just sustainable foods for their families. So it's been a wide variety, but we really have intentionally said, how can we provide support in terms of food, shelter, and safety?
So that's obviously addressing the short-term needs, which are significant, but there's going to be a long-term need in terms of the economic impact, even after we get past this pandemic. Have you even had a chance to think about what your strategy might be in the long-term, or right now is your energy really just focused on those immediate pressing needs that the community has?
So that, you know what, that's what keeps me up at night, because while our day-to-day operations are focused on just getting funds and resources out as quickly as we can to those organizations that need it the most, I do realize that, and I mentioned that's the first tranche. So the second tranche to me is, how do we continue to support an expanding population, which I believe it's going to be an expanding population of vulnerable folks. And then also linked very closely with that is, how do we stand up and support the nonprofit organizations who have been hit hard by this pandemic? They've lost program funding. They've lost fundraising events. They've lost a variety of things. And so while there are resources, and we try as best we can to link them to, whether it's payroll protection, whether it's emergency loan funding, whether it's just some basic technology needs. I believe that the real work is going to come in that second tranche. And I'm happy to say that we are regularly engaged with the other community foundations serving the Central Valley. So Central Valley Community Foundation, Stanislaus Community Foundation, and San Joaquin Community Foundation, and really trying to figure out how we can bring more resources to the Central Valley, because unfortunately, if you look at the state of California, resources just don't, philanthropic resources do not come to this area at the same levels that they go to the metropolitan areas, the Bay Area and Southern California. So if our thinking is if we can band together and if we can really think strategically about how to support the nonprofit organizations and how to think, you know, what's that long play for really making a difference in hitting those really critical areas. So there's a lot of work to be done.
Without a doubt. You're listening to Valley Edition. Today, we're talking about the impact of COVID-19 on the Valley's most vulnerable communities. Before the break, we were talking about how organizations are finding the balance between addressing the short-term and the long-term needs of people who are suffering right now. And I'd like to hear now from Laura Moreno, a chair of the Fresno Madera Continuum of Care. Given the amount of job loss we have seen and continue to see, what impact do you think that will have in the long-term on homeless rates?
So I definitely think we're gonna, that this is going to have an impact on what we see on the street. And so when you have high rates of unemployment, when you have people that can't pay their rent, one of the things that concerns me, and I was having a conversation with an organization about this, is the whole issue around the rent forgiveness for the time being. So the moratorium on evictions, and if somebody can't pay their rent, then the landlord can't kick them out, which is a great idea in concept. But if somebody is just barely making their rent and it's, say, $800 or $900 a month, and so they've lost their job and maybe they're not paying their rent, then 3 months from now, when this is slowed down and they're back to work, they're at the point where they owe $2,700. And so if somebody was struggling with the $800 or $900 monthly rent, having to come up with $2,700 is going to be a whole lot tougher. So I think that we're going to see a whole lot of different issues that pop up, whether it's specifically those homeless that are on the street or whether we see an uptick because of the moratorium on evictions, but then it comes into play in month 3, 4, 5, or 6. We're going to have to do something a little bit different. And so as the continuum of care and the partners are looking at how we ramp up, you know, quickly to add more beds and bring more people inside, we need to start planning for what happens at the end of this. When COVID has eased up some, we have added 400 people into shelters. How do we then help them transition from a shelter into something more permanent? And so if we see an increase in people on the street because of loss of jobs and reduced income and businesses closing, we're going to have 400 to 500 people that are we just going to open the door and say, okay, COVID's over, so you know we're going to close these shelters now because the money was temporary, and we release them on the street again? Or how do we start planning for something a little more long-term and how we move people into something more permanent? So that's something that we're having to look at right now in the midst of COVID. How do we plan for the lessening of this, and how do we move people into something more permanent and not just release them onto the street again? So I think that it's twofold. It's the increases because of the loss of jobs, the loss of employment, the closing of businesses, and also all the people that we brought inside. How do we transition them, and where do we find the money to transition them? Because the money that's coming in right now is it's immediate and it's an emergency situation. It's not really meant for long term.
Absolutely. Let's turn back to Lisa Blecker and our conversation we were having earlier about the shortage of PPE for ag workers who are dealing with pesticides. What advice do you have for ag workers who are applying pesticides and may not have access to the PPE that they need?
Well, thank you for that question. That is a question that I deal with in my daily job even when we are not in the midst of this COVID-19 crisis. You know, it is always important to follow the pesticide label and California regulations for using the correct PPE. There is a reason why PPE is required by the label and regulations. It's to prevent, you know, the acute hazards, but also the long-term exposure to pesticides. California regulations are often more stringent than label directions. So for handlers applying pesticides, they need to know what the California regulations require in addition to what the pesticide label says. So in California, most of our employees that are handling pesticides have to wear chemical-resistant gloves and protection for their eyes, even if the label doesn't require them. And it's not okay to handle pesticides without the adequate PPE. So all of our pesticide handlers, whether they have a qualified applicator certification or if they're licensed or if they're trained annually as a handler, they should all understand before handling any pesticide at all how PPE protects them and what PPE is required. So we have extensive training requirements. And so if a handler can't find the correct PPE that's identified by both the pesticide label and California regulations, they need to seek help from their employer in identifying a solution. One solution could be to find replacement PPE that is at least as protective or potentially more protective, or they can work with their employer to identify other pesticides that could be used that don't require as much PPE or that don't require the PPE that they cannot identify, that they can't find. One thing I've been telling people is to use reusable PPE when possible. You know, our healthcare workers are more likely to use disposable gloves and disposable coveralls, whereas in agriculture and other industries where we apply pesticides, a tightly woven cotton coverall that completely covers the arms, torso, and legs is an acceptable substitute for these disposable coveralls. So using reusable PPE really reduces the demand on the PPE supply. And so they can be washed, those cotton coveralls can be washed and reworn multiple times. Most people are going to be wearing a minimum of long sleeve shirt, long pants, socks, closed toed shoes, some chemical resistant glove, and protection for their eyes. Sometimes our pesticide handlers need to wear a respirator. And it's important to pay attention to what the label is requiring of your respirator, because respirators can protect you from two different types of contaminants, either a particulate or a vapor. And so whatever your label is telling you you need protection from, it's really important to know that when you're identifying something, an alternative. So for example, the N95 respirators that healthcare workers use and are critical for them right now, our ag workers are not going to be able to find them as easily, but if they have a reusable elastomeric respirator mask that they can add a particulate filter to, that's a good alternative for them.
There are options, right? But I'm just wondering if this situation might cause some farmers to step back from their use of pesticides and then whether or not this could have some impact on the food supply chain.
You know, I think the impact on the food supply chain is really unclear. There are so many forces exerting pressure on the food supply chain at the moment, COVID being one of them and causing many of those pressures. I don't know if PPE directly will impact the food supply chain. I think it has the potential to impact business operations because if people can't find the correct PPE for their workers, then they have to make this really tough choice of not applying that pesticide. And what does that mean? That they don't apply any pesticide at all? Or do they identify a pesticide that, for example, doesn't require an N95 respirator? And maybe that pesticide isn't as efficacious, or then that requires additional training for their applicators, because we train our handlers and applicators on every individual pesticide that they're handling.
I'd like to come back to Kristen and talk quickly about education. What role do you see
the Kern Community Foundation playing to minimize the impact of school closures on educational attainment?
We continue to do what we can to support our educators. We envision that once there's some normalcy back, that our districts, the 47 districts that exist in Kern, and that's 47 K-12 districts, they'll all come back together and we will discuss lessons learned and what can be changed going forward. They all have agreed to and operate under what's called the Kern Education Pledge. And so we will get back to focusing on that. Right now, it's all about how to best serve the students in these uncertain times and these extenuating circumstances. From a just real boots on the ground piece, you know, we are a large scholarship provider in Kern County. Over the last 4 years, have generated over $2 million in scholarships to 1,100 students. And I'm happy to say that because of the platform that we use and the technology that is available to us, that application program is still continuing. In fact, we're in the midst of evaluating some 500 applications that have been submitted by graduating seniors. Things are going to look a little bit different. You know, transcripts are going to look a little bit different. But our role is really to make sure that we help to filter the information and lower that stress level for our students. So many of our students are first generation college going, and we want to make sure that they don't become unhinged in these uncertain times and wash away that long-term goal of a post-secondary experience. My fear is that we'll have students who say, never mind, I'm going to stay home and not go to college. And so we just do what we can to support and to be that extra safety net for students. We will be generating almost $300,000 in scholarships this year. And things are, again, they're going to look a little bit different. We don't have those award nights and those celebrations, but instead, you know, we can do different things and do our best. Our team is working on how to create a celebratory environment using social distancing protocols. So look for more to come on that. But education is still plays a critical role in the work that we do. This may seem like a misstep and maybe even possibly that we're moving backwards, but actually I think it's a true opportunity for us. I think our educators are doing a phenomenal job with providing learning opportunities, whether it's distance or any variety. They're being very, very creative. But I think at the end of the day, when this we've moved past the social distancing and are back to some level of normalcy, we'll be able to use the information and the experiences that have been revealed to really explore where are our weaknesses and where are our strengths and what can we do to improve them.
Certainly. It's a silver lining amidst all of this. You know, we just have a minute or two before we need to wrap up, and I'd like to give Laura Moreno the last word. You spoke earlier about the increase in capacity in Fresno and Madera County to house people who are experiencing homelessness. Can you speak to what is happening at shelters to prevent the spread of COVID-19?
Yes, absolutely. This is a really important component of our plan as well. So it was not only bring online new shelter beds, but as well ensure that the shelters that we have are safe. We need staff to be safe, to feel safe. We need clients to be safe and to feel safe. And so we looked at what their needs were. The state has offered PPEs for our shelter providers as well, and so the Department of Behavioral Health has been instrumental in organizing that and distributing PPEs. We brought in disinfecting companies, so they come into the shelters once a week and they do a complete disinfecting so that, again, we're sure that our staff are safe and that we're sure that our clients are safe. We've also worked at, like, everybody had trouble finding toilet paper, so did shelters. And so the county partnered with all the shelters to ensure that they had access. So we were able to order toilet paper and some of the necessary supplies to keep the shelters functioning. So that was a really important piece as well. And it's been the partnership between the city, the county, of Madera, the departments of behavioral health and departments of social services, as well as our continuum providers that have allowed us to truly keep our shelters, our existing shelters safe, keep them functioning, keeping the shelter in place for shelter residents as well, and ensuring that we have a workforce that feels safe and is able to come in, because that is frontline work that our shelter workers are doing. Our outreach team are doing frontline work as well and making sure that they have the supplies to clean their vans when they transport people from the street. They've also had to transport people from hospitals who are positive. And so making sure that they have all of the equipment they have has been one of the most important things that we've been working on.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the work that you're doing, the work that all of you are doing to protect our vulnerable communities. And thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. One of the most important tools to fight a pandemic is a well-informed public. But much of the information we encounter online is questionable or just flat-out false. I spoke with Donald Barclay, a UC Merced librarian and author of the book Fake News, Propaganda, and Plain Old Lies. I asked him to share some of the false information he's encountered about COVID-19.
There are lots of bad medical information. One that was going around is that, you know, if you drink a lot of water, you won't get COVID-19 because it washes the virus out of your body, you know, or certain, you know, if you take this medicine, it'll keep you from getting COVID-19. Or if you take ibuprofen when you have COVID-19, you'll die, which turns out to not be true. And so there's a couple of things going on there with that kind of bad medical information, which is there, in some cases, there are people who stand to make money out of bad medical information by, you know, hey, I've got this special elixir here, and if you buy it from me, you know, it'll keep you from getting COVID-19. The government doesn't want you to know about it because, you know, for some crazy reason, because obviously if you think about it, if somebody had something that would prevent COVID-19, wouldn't the government, the president, Congress, the CDC, everybody with a stake in ending this, the business people would be all over that and getting it to people as fast as they could? Of course they would. You know, on the one hand, if you think about something like, you know, some celebrity like Gwyneth Paltrow is selling something that basically, oh, if you take this, it'll give you an aligned chakra and make your feng shui better. And you look at that and you go, well, that's silly. And if somebody wants to buy that and throw their money away on some dumb thing that Gwyneth Paltrow is saying, let them, that's fine. But when somebody's saying, if you take this, it'll keep you from getting COVID and it makes you careless and makes you ignore social distancing and do all that stuff, that's very, very dangerous. That's a very much a public health issue. And that's why that kind of misinformation is really bad. And then, of course, there's sort of the conspiracy information of, you know, oh, it's all a lie. It's an attempt to disempower us and keep us locked up and, you know, whatever, you know, evil thing you think the government's going to do next or big business is going to do or whatever. Somebody, you know, for some reason has dreamed this up to take advantage of it. So those are the kind of information that's coming out. And then the other problem you've got is it's a very fast moving kind of thing. And there's a lot of information is changing a lot. And so 2 weeks ago, very credible scientific people were saying, don't wear a mask. It's not going to help you. Now they're saying, well, we changed our mind. It is. So there's two ways to look at that. One way, which I would consider the rational way, would be this is a very fast moving situation. People are learning a lot. As the medical people figured out more what was going on, they realized, let's change our minds about what we're saying about masks and advise people to wear a mask. We have a different take on it now. I would consider that the rational way to look at that information. The irrational way to look at it is those scientists don't know what they're talking about. We might as well do whatever we want or whatever makes us feel good or whatever we wanted to do in the first place. And that's the wrong way to look at it. And I think that's a problem you often find with really credible information, which is that credible scientists and credible researchers will change their minds on things because as they get more information, they think about things differently. And discredible people tend to stick to their guns and to never change. And somehow that the fact that this crazy person ranting over here that saying that COVID is not really a thing or saying that, you know, drinking cranberry juice will keep you from getting COVID and they stick to their guns and they never change, somehow that seems more credible than people who change their minds. But it's not true. Because one of the things about science and medicine is people learn as they go along. So it does change. And that's a hard thing, I think, sometimes for people to understand, is that when you're dealing with scientific and medical information, especially in a very new and fast-changing environment, yeah, sometimes the information is going to change. That's the nature of that kind of research. And also to understand that no information, even the very best scientific information, it's created by human beings. Well, human beings are imperfect, but just because scientists are human and they're not perfect doesn't mean that they're not giving us the very best information out there and the information we really should be paying attention to. And I think, you know, one of the things that you could really do to help yourself, my advice to anybody who's really studying this, would be to look at, I think really the best website to start with for anybody is a website called Medline Plus. And it's put out by the National Institutes of Health through the National Library of Medicine. And they have a whole section on COVID-19. And they have really the best, most up-to-date scientific information there. And I would just recommend to anybody, any layperson who wants to get the best idea of what's going on, to start with that site and look at what they have to say. They link to government sites from there, but they also link to non-government sites like the Mayo Clinic and research universities like UC San Francisco and the Texas Medical Center and all these other places that are doing research to really give you a good idea of what's the best and latest medical and scientific thinking is. And of course, one of the things you really want to do when you're looking at a fast-moving, fast-changing situation like what's happening with COVID is to really pay attention to the date of the information, not just the date it was published, but the date it was created, because we know things are changing quickly. And we really want to keep up on what's the latest thinking on this.
It's just incredibly confusing right now for all of the reasons you identified. Information is moving so fast. Things are changing. Scientists are learning more and more about how the coronavirus operates. But then we're also getting conflicting information at times from government officials, from people in positions of authority. So it's really difficult to keep ourselves informed and up to date. And I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are about how our psychology plays into our susceptibility to being misled or just plain duped.
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple things that go on in our psychological makeup. You know, some of it, I think, has to do with our worldview of how we see the world, whether we're liberal or conservative, religious or not religious, you know, whether our outlook is optimistic or pessimistic. We can tend to sort of look at the information that confirms our view of the world. And we all do that. And believe me, I'm as guilty as anybody of this kind of thing, because I'm as susceptible to psychological influences anybody else and to my own orientation to the world and the way I see things. And even though I study information and I've spent a lot of time thinking and writing about fake news, I know that I'm susceptible. So just being aware of how susceptible we are. So when we read something that really confirms our view and makes us feel good about ourselves and makes us feel like we were right and they were wrong, we want to jump on it. And sometimes we have to be very careful that we don't. You know, because we have to stop and think, am I letting my emotions and my feelings, my outlook overcome my common sense or my objectivity? So that's part of what's going on. We also have some tendencies to something that's called anchoring, which is where we often, the first information we get about something, we tend to latch onto that and we give it a lot of weight, even as we find additional information later that might contradict it. We still put a lot of weight because that's the first thing we heard. And we also have a tendency to put a lot of weight when it comes from people we know and trust. You know, maybe we really love Tom Hanks, the actor. So if Tom Hanks has said something about COVID-19, we might want to believe it because we don't even know him, but we believe he's this nice guy and he's got this great reputation. Or, you know, maybe we like Clint Eastwood and so we're going to latch on to what Clint Eastwood tells us. Well, Tom Hanks and Clint Eastwood might be doing a great job of relaying the very best and most scientific information. Well, they might not be. They aren't medical experts. So we need to be careful about that. The same thing, not just Clint Eastwood and Tom Hanks, but your Aunt Frances or your brother or, you know, your spouse or anybody else who you might really, really trust, you know, we tend to put more weight on what they say. So we have to be careful about those kind of connections that we make to people who maybe their information is not that great, even though they're a good person and we trust them. So one of the things I would really advise anybody is, you know, in some ways it's a fast moving situation, but in other ways, partly because of the fact that a lot of us are not going into work every day. We're either working from home or, very unfortunately, some people are out of work. We have a lot of time to think about it. So give yourself some time. When you read something and you go, that sounds right to me, that sounds really good, sleep on it. Give it a little time. Take some time to look and see, this sounds really good to me. I'm really convinced that this is the right way to go. Can I find other information, independent information that confirms it? Can I find independent information that contradicts it? You know, and try to really think carefully about that.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I'm always happy to talk about information. And if I can help people think more clearly about information and make better choices, that's what information is for. It's for making good, well-informed decisions. And to make good decisions, we have to have the best information at our disposal.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. These days, do you ever find yourself looking out of the window of your house or apartment and wondering, how are my neighbors doing during this pandemic? Maybe now's a good time to check in. FM89's news director, Alice Daniel, kept thinking about her neighbor, Dorothy Jones, so she gave her a call. Jones turns 100 this year, and she still lives in her home in the Fresno High area.
I first reached out to Dorothy through her daughter, Kate Jones. Dorothy has 4 grown children, and they take turns caring for her. When Kate calls me back to leave a message,
"Hi, Alice. Kate here, across the street."
Dorothy chimes in.
"Well, Alice, I'm delighted that we'll be seeing you. The fact that we'll be sharing some thoughts and visitation is exciting."
She says she doesn't want the pandemic to ruin the warmth of the neighborhood, and she suggests a time to meet.
"We'll keep calling until we catch you. We'll track you down someplace."
As much as I'd like to sit right next to Dorothy, microphone in hand, coffee and cake on the table nearby, we decide the safest way to have a conversation is by phone.
Hi, Dorothy.
Yes, here I am, waiting to hear from you, Alice.
Well, Dorothy, it's very nice of you to take the time.
I tell her I want to know how someone who was born a century ago and has lived through so many historic events is faring now.
"You know, I'm surprising myself that I'm accepting everything. I realize there's not much any of us can do. And since I just lost my driver's license in November because of the test I failed to take at the DMV, I'm stuck here at home anyway."
She says, thank heavens for TV and books. At night, she and Kate sometimes read out loud to each other.
"You never stepped in to give me a chance to tell you my side of it. You just..."
That's from To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee.
Uncle Jack scratched his head. "What was your side of it, Scout?"
But with all this, Dorothy says, there are things she misses.
"Yeah, I'm sick of the whole mess. I'm sick of the fact that you can't go get your nails done. You can't go get your hair done. You can't go to the casino."
Do you typically go to the casino?
"I love to go. I don't go often because I don't drive up there by myself. And none of my kids enjoy it, so none of them even like to take me up there. They will under pressure."
Before the pandemic, she and her friend Maria would sometimes take to the road. Maria helps her with housework.
She loves to go, so I've been with her. A couple of times she and I've driven up there. It's only a half hour's drive.
Dorothy grew up in Rock Hill, South Carolina. She was born on November 29, 1920, right after another pandemic, the Spanish flu, killed at least 50 million people worldwide. She remembers her parents talking about it.
"My father had been in World War I. He'd been in the cavalry. Oh, ho, ho. Didn't know how to ride a horse, but he was in the cavalry. And they talked about it because it was as widespread as what we are going through now with this miserable thing. They were all scared to death. nobody in their families died from it, which was quite unusual because most families had deaths of multiple deaths, actually.
The Great Depression followed.
My father was a barber, and barbers didn't make a whole lot of money, you know. But he did a lot of bartering, and some of our things that would appear on the table might be a chicken that was raised in somebody else's yard that they brought and traded to my father for a haircut.
In those hard times, she and her five siblings learned to laugh a lot. She recalls the day her brother hung a little note around the neck of a neighbor's chicken who was eating their mother's garden seeds.
And it said on the little note, "I've been a bad bird. If I am caught in Mrs. Robinson's yard again, I will be found in her cooking pot the next day." And we thought that was hilarious. And I still do.
Dorothy says she really wanted to go to college after high school, but it was just too expensive. And then World War II broke out. She decided to enlist in the Navy. First stop, Stillwater, Oklahoma.
At the university there that had been suddenly changed into a training session for prospective Navy waves that we were called. And that's what I did. And for the next 4 years, I served in the Navy.
She started at an office in Charleston and worked as a recruiter in the Southeast. And then she went to Hawaii.
And I was assigned to the best duty on the base, on the Big Island. And I was secretary to the CO there.
After the war, she eventually moved west to Stockton, where she worked for the Veterans Administration. There, she met and fell in love with a man from Fresno, which is how she got here. Her children say her optimism remains irrepressible, even in times like these.
Oh, why not? I can't imagine not being that way. I can't imagine being gloomy and even going through what we are now. We'll get over this, you know. It might take longer than we'd like, and I might not get my hair fixed every week.
She says every night before she goes to bed, she stares up at a crack in her ceiling, a kind of portal to God.
I talk to God. We discuss what's happened during the day and what should have happened and what didn't. And then I know tomorrow will be ready for me, and I'll be ready for it, more or less.
After I hung up with Dorothy, I realized I never asked her the secret to a long life. So I reached out again, and her witty one-line response? The fact that I was born so long ago. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Alice Daniel.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all of this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Laura Satsui, and Madi Bolaños. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, standing with all Californians as we address the coronavirus emergency together on the web at chcf.org.